Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by the one and only folk music legend Judy Collins, who's going to be performing a recreation of her 1964 concert hall performance, and it'll be streaming on Wolf Trap's website, probably among other places. Hey, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
All right, so in case some of our listeners maybe don't remember, remind us what the Town Hall, 64 performance was, and how you hooked up with Wolf Trap to stream it.
Wolf Trap, I've been at for many years, many, many times. I think in your history, you'll find Mrs. Schaus always said that I've been there for 25 years in a row or something. So I know Wolf Trap's stages very well. But before I ever got to Wolf Trap, I sang at Town Hall. It was my first solo concert in 1964, almost 60 years ago. And I was told by my record label president, Jack Holzman, that we should record it. And I had things that it was 5 months since JFK had been assassinated. I had lived in the village for about, well, maybe 8 months, 10 months. It hadn't been a year yet. And I was in the village, so I was surrounded by all these wonderful singer-songwriters, Bob Dylan and Tom Paxton and Shel Silverstein. And so I had a batch of new songs to me that I was starting to sing. But then my first town hall concert came along. It was March 27th of 1964, and I was 24. I wasn't even 25 yet. And so that's the concert that we are repeating, or I say recreating in a way, which will be broadcast on the 12th. That's tomorrow, I think, the Saturday or Friday. On the Wolf Trap schedule and on the Town Hall schedule. So in this concert, I'm doing a number of repeats. I'm doing Bob Dylan's great song, "The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll," which is a significant piece of writing. It sort of goes along with "To Kill a Mockingbird" in terms of it setting the tone for what had been happening and unfortunately, is still happening one way or another in terms of racism in this country. And I sang a number of Tom Paxton songs, which I've recreated, and also Billy Ed Wheeler songs. So I had a wonderful experience talking about the 60s, about what was going on that year, and what we were all going through.
Awesome. And just so our listeners know, we're referencing Town Hall. It's on West 43rd Street between 6th Avenue and Broadway up in Midtown Manhattan, a very famous venue. So where exactly, that was where you did it in 64. Where did you record this new one? Are you going back to Town Hall?
Yes, same place, same stage. The stage that was originally created or inhabited by the suffragettes in 1921, 100 years ago. And I tell a little bit of the story of Town Hall because so many extraordinary artists have performed there. Of course, Paul, you remember his name and I don't, and I'm sorry to say, all kinds of artists. My teacher, which is what's confusing me because I keep getting focused on it, my teacher, Antonia Brico, I studied with for a number of years when I was a young girl, and I played with her orchestra. And she was the first woman conductor of major symphonies in the world. Paul Robeson is whom I'm thinking of. Paul Robeson played there. The Suffragettes opened it up. The stage itself has been the setting for many, many extraordinary events. And Dr. Brico, who was my teacher, and her first, by the way, her first gig was conducting the Berlin Philharmonic when she was 27, I think. It was in 1929, a few years before. She had her own orchestra in New York, and she performed on the stage of Town Hall, and she also had performances on the stage of Carnegie Hall in New York. So the stage itself has been the host to hundreds of incredible performances. And I've performed there a number of times in my life, and I've watched other concerts there. I've seen Pete Seeger there. I saw Dylan there before the concert in 64. I saw him in 62 in his first stage performance. And I was sitting there with Jack Holzman and listening to the songs, and Jack kept poking me in the arm and saying, okay, that one, that one, that one. And I think that I heard The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll there for the first time.
Wow, that's so cool. I never knew that you saw Dylan that early. Well, remind our listeners how you made your way to New York in the first place. I know you were born in Seattle. You know, how did that journey, you know, were you listening to Woody Guthrie and Seeger and them and said, you know, I got to be part of that Greenwich Village scene? Or how did that come about?
I sort of came in the side door because I was a classical pianist and also a singer, and I learned all the songs of Rodgers and Hart and from my father, who had a radio show for 30 years and sang the Great American Songbook. So I was grew up doing a multifaceted arena of music. I played Mozart and Chopin and Debussy and Rachmaninoff. And then I sang in the church choirs and the choruses at school. I had a job with the Jack Blues dance band singing Wish You Were Here and, Laura and My Funny Valentine. And while I was practicing the piano every day for 2 hours or so, I had a little performance group. There were three of us, so it was a group, a trio, I suppose. I played the piano and sat at the piano and told the story of Little Red Riding Hood. And my friends, who were both two women now, they're women, they're still my best friends, they were dancers. So they performed the stories of the Little Red Riding Hood. And we brought in our very tall friend, Peggy, to play the woodchopper. And we did this performance of Little Red Riding Hood starting in probably 1953 or four. We did it all over Denver, which is where I live. And we did it at the Elks Club and the Kiwanis Club and all the places in Denver, the hospitals and the Lowry Air Force Base. And so I was looking for material. And I was now I was 15 or so. And I was playing the piano one day, practicing my Rachmaninoff, and I turned on the radio. And I suppose it was because I was looking for new material. We'd done the Little Red Riding Hood everywhere, and it was sort of worn out in Denver. They were kind of sick of seeing us do this thing. And so I turned the radio on, I don't know, sort of wandering around as you do when you're supposed to be practicing. And there on the radio was the Gypsy Rover. You remember the Gypsy Rover came out down to the valley so shady. He whistled and he sang till the greenwood rang, and he won the heart of a lady. And that was it. I heard the song. I said, oh my God, what a great story. We need that. We need to have Marcia and Carol dance that story, and I'll tell the story. I'll sing the song and I'll get somebody to play the guitar. And I was off to the races. That's how it all started.
Awesome. That thank you for singing a little portion of that. How did you get signed? How did Elektra Records sign you? I guess you were what, 22 for that debut album, A Maid of Constant Sorrow in 61. How did the record deal actually come about?
When I was 19, I'd been singing and playing the guitar for a couple of years, and I collected a lot of songs. I loved it. I always bought the records. But I didn't know anything about clubs the Great Folk Scare was not in full force yet. And it was mostly records that I listened to. And also we had a little Denver Folklore Center club where we'd get together and everybody would sing the version of the Gypsy Rover that they knew from childhood or something. And so I didn't know that it was possible to do this for a living. I had no clue. But in 1959, in March, my then husband said to me, why don't you get a job doing something you know how to do? So I went down to Michael's Pub in Boulder, where we were living, and I auditioned and I got a job. And I've never stopped performing and sometimes even getting paid for it. So that was the beginning. And one of the places that I met Dylan in those days, because the first place that I played at was a place in Denver called The Exodus, the second place, because I worked at in Boulder at Michael's Pub, and I worked there a lot. And then I went to the mountains and sang at the Gilded Garter in Central City. And that's where I met Dylan. He would come up. He was already in Colorado. And his name, of course, was Robert Zimmerman, as we famously remember. And he was homeless, and he looked, raggedy would be putting it mildly. And he was always looking for a job. He was trying to get on the Hootenanny. So he would come up to Central City, and he used to say to me, you know, I sang at your feet. He would sit down and listen to me sitting on the floor and listen to me at that funky club that I was singing at in Central City. And then I sang at a place called in Denver called the Bitter, not the Bitter End, something else. I can't remember the name of that. And again, he was still homeless. He was still singing. And I opened for Josh White. And then I opened for a guy named Bob Gibson. Bob Gibson famously had, in the previous year, had called Maynard Solomon and some other people in New York. I think he called Al Grossman about him and said, I found this great singer, Joan Baez. And then he told the guy who started the Newport Festival, Jazz Festival, who was starting a folk festival in 59, he told him about Joan and said, I think I have your star for, he brought her on, actually, Bob Gibson brought on Joan Baez in his set, and she sang, and of course it was a worldwide explosion of a new talent. And Bob Gibson was playing at Forever Yours or whatever that club was called. And he called Jack Holzman and said, I think I found your Joan Baez. And so Jack Holzman, who was the president and founder of Electric, came to Denver and he sat in the audience at whatever the name of this club is. I'll think of it any minute. Hal Neustadter was the man who founded it. And he said many, many, many years later, in fact, I didn't hear this story until only a couple of years ago. He came to Denver, Jack Holzman did, and he listened, but he did not introduce himself to me. And what he told me, he's still my friend. He still works with Warners. He's fabulous. I adore him. And he said to me, you know, I went to hear you, but I thought, you know, she has a gift of some sort, but I don't know if she has it for the long run. Now, had he asked me, did I have it for the long run? I would have told him, you bet I'm here for the long run. But he didn't. So 2 years later, I was in New York. And again, I ran into Dylan. He was there. He was still named Robert Zimmerman. It was 1961. He was still singing old Woody Guthrie songs, badly, I thought, by the way. And he still looked like this raggedy-tailed, you know, kid, homeless. He was still homeless. He was living in other people's apartments. And Jack came to see me at the Bitter End, the Village Gate, where I was doing a television show with a number of people. I was there with the Clancy Brothers and a couple of the singers that were on Electra too. And he captured my attention by coming up to me and saying after the show, Judy, my dear, you're ready to make an album. So that was how it happened. It was April 11th, 1961. I made an agreement on a shand and on a handshake. And about a week later, Jack Rollins it wasn't Jack Rollins who put me in touch with the man who ran the Columbia shop. And I said, well, you know, I already have an agreement. And he said, do you have it signed? I said, no, I did this on a handshake and I'm old fashioned. I believe that a handshake is a commitment. So that's how I got to Jack Holzman in 1961. So I made my first album, Made of Constant Sorrow. You're right, I was 22 that year. And I was already a road warrior. I'd been out and about in all the cities. And, you know, in those days, it was sort of word of mouth. One club would tell the next that, you know, that you were good. And so you'd go on and play in Oklahoma City, and then you'd go up to Canada and play at Le Boo, and then you'd go to Chicago and play at the Gate of Horn. That was the way it went.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing how, I mean, I was expecting he signed me with this and I just got the full backstory. You just gave me gold. So thank you for all that gold.
And by the way, the name of the club in Denver where Dylan and I met, and I met Bob Gibson and all kinds of wonderful people, was the Exodus. And the Exodus was very famous for a long time. And it was really a fantastic folk club and one of the many in the country in those days.
Awesome. I will have to punch the Exodus into Google and research all about its history. I'm excited to check it out.
Yeah, it was a great club.
Denver's a great, so much fun city. Okay, so that was sort of the run up to, you know, your breakthrough, your debut album, Made of Constant Sorrow. But I know, you know, you became a household name for sure with Wildflowers. By then, everybody knew you because of Both Sides Now. You won your Grammy for it. Tell me the first time that, you know, how did you first discover, you know, Joni Mitchell wrote it, obviously, but you were the first to record it. How was that gifted to you? I mean, that's an all-timer, and you were lucky enough to be there and be the first to record it.
I was totally lucky because my friend Al Cooper, who started Blood, Sweat, and Tears, knew my phone number by heart. That's really how this happened. And he had met Joni, hadn't heard her sing, but he met her at a club one night and followed her home because she told him that she wrote songs and she was good looking, according to him. So at 3 a.m, he called me and I was sound asleep, you know, dead drunk, probably 1967. And I had already found or been discovered by Leonard Cohen, and I had sung a lot of Canadian singer songs by that time. I'd recorded Ed McCurdy, I'd recorded Ian and Sylvia, Gordon, Lightfoot. And so when Al called me, he said, did I wake you? I said, yeah, you did. But then he said, I think you'll be happy that I called you. And then he put Joni Mitchell on and she sang me Both Sides Now. So that's how that happened.
And what a beautiful song it is too. I mean, you can't look at a cloud without thinking of your song.
No, that's true. It's a wonderful song and she's a magnificent writer. And I've been privileged to record a number of her songs, including recently I did a version of River. I don't know why I didn't record it before. It's such a great song, but I put it on this recent album of mine, which went immediately to the top number one on the bluegrass charts. And it is a version of River. So it was the first time I got to sing River with a group called the Chatham County Line Bluegrass Group and a friend of mine from Norway named Jonas Fjeld. So I finally got my hands on River.
Awesome. So everyone, yeah, if you liked Both Sides Now, check out River if you haven't. Well, gosh, we could... so many songs we could go through. Someday Soon, Chelsea Morning, Cook with Honey, there's so many, but my listeners would kill me if I don't at least ask you about Send in the Clowns, because that was such a huge one from Sondheim, you know. Well, it was on Broadway with A Little Night Music, but how did that come to you in terms of hey, let's take this Broadway song and put it out on your album on Judith? And I think Sondheim won Song of the Year with that, right?
He did. I was sitting here in the apartment where I'm sitting right now, and I got a call from my friend Nancy Bacall, who was a very good friend of Leonard Cohen's. And he had introduced her to me a few years before that. And she said, I know you're kind of struggling to find out what's next. in the world for you? And I said, yes, I am. And she said, I'm sending this over. This was 1973. And I didn't know who Sondheim was. I guess I might have heard of him, but not so that it stuck. And I didn't know what Little Night Music was, because my Broadway experiences were really restricted to things like the Marat Sade, maybe, and going to the Living Theater downtown. But I don't think, I think I saw a production of the play about Marilyn Monroe. I think The Fall, it's called. Anyway, that's about it. So I didn't know who he was, and I didn't know about Little Night Music. So she said, I want you to play this song, and then you call me. And I, you know, it was a record, a big cast album of Little Night Music. So I put the needle on the cut and I played the song, and I immediately called Hal Prince, who was his producer. And I said, you know, you have a great song here on this show. And he said, yes. He said, about 200 people have already recorded it. And I said, I don't care. I have to sing it. I'll tell you a funny story, which probably it's probably incorrect, politically incorrect to tell it, but
go for it.
I recorded it in New York, of course, and Elektra was all primed to put it out in 73. And the president of Elektra got a call from Frank Sinatra's people, you know, let my people call your people. And they said to Joe Smith, who was the president of Elektra at that point, we'd like Miss Collins to hold her release of the song. We want to put out Mr. Sinatra's version first. And you know what they said. You can imagine.
Oh, yes, we can. That's great. Thanks for that little tidbit. Awesome. Well, there's so much we could talk about in your career. Is it true? It's not a song you recorded, but is it true that the Sweet Judy Blue Eyes was written about you, Stephen Stills?
Yes, it was written about me. I don't know whether we got it on camera. We did a tour together. We did a year and a half of concerts, 115 concerts in a year and a half. Stephen and I did it. And every night we sang it together. We were on stage for 2 hours together, which is very unusual for a duo. And we had a wonderful time. And at the end of each of those shows, we sang Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. I think the only people that recorded that were the CBS team from the CBS Sunday morning show. They might have it. We might have some rights to use it or play it. I don't think I've ever heard it, but I think we could get at it if we tried hard enough.
When was that you did that?
About 2 years ago, maybe. Okay. 2 years ago, I think.
Gotcha. That's really cool. I'm going to have to find that clip. I've never actually seen that, you know, you guys doing it on stage together. Awesome. Well, what else could we talk? I mean, you co-directed an Oscar nominated documentary. I remember you at Kennedy Center Spring Gala singing In My Life, a beautiful rendition of that one that you did the John Lennon tribute. There's so much we could talk about, but why don't I ask you about when the Library of Congress chose Amazing Grace for the National Recording Registry. I mean, that must have just been an honor for you. For such an iconic song, they chose your version.
Yeah, I was thrilled. And I got a call from Jack Holzman. Are you talking about Amazing Grace or Both Sides Now? Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, yeah, it was Amazing Grace.
I didn't know that it was going on. The Library of Congress has my archives. They bought my archives a number of years ago. Now it's time to put a bunch of, you know, you get everything out the door and then all of a sudden it starts building up over the past 10 years.
Yeah.
So I have to get them over here to take the rest of this stuff away. Anyway, Jack called me and said, congratulations. I know why I'm confused, because the first thing he called me and told me was that the movie that I made about Dr. Brico called Antonia, A Portrait of the Woman, that is also in the Library of Congress. It was put into the Library of Congress for the five movies from 1975, one of which is Chinatown. So I think we're in very good company. And then he called me about Amazing Grace a few years ago. I didn't know about either one of those things. I wasn't particularly in the dark. I was just on the road somewhere and didn't notice.
Right. You're right. Yeah, you're right. The Library of Congress put your documentary into the film registry, and then they have Amazing Grace in the recording registry.
Yeah. That's not bad, is it?
No, you know why? Because your stuff stands the test of time. I think that's just proof of it right there. They're archiving it for future generations to listen. Once you and I and everyone else are long gone, it'll still be in there, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Awesome. Well, just in closing, outside of music, I know you've been a big activist. You even came into WTOP a couple years ago in studio. You came in and talked about, I think it was a suicide prevention thing. Talk about how that, why that is such an important issue to you, and memories of Clark as well.
Well, I was fortunate to be raised in a very activist family. My father was very public about his political views, and he talked about them on the radio, and he talked about the war in Vietnam and about many aspects of what goes on in society that he didn't agree with and that he was not happy with. And he taught us to do the same thing. He said, that nowadays they say, when you see something, say something. And he always said, when you see something, do something. And so we always had that idea about what we were supposed to do. We were supposed to be part of the solution. And so ever since then, I've taken an active part in speaking out about things. I think when I first started writing, I started talking about the secrets in the family, the main one of which was alcoholism. And my father was an alcoholic and I'm an alcoholic. So I didn't know that I was allowed to speak about it. I wasn't. It was a big secret. And so one of the first things I talked about was mental health and alcoholism and what had happened to me in my life because of that illness that I have. And I've been sober for almost, I'm in my 43rd year now of being sober.
Congratulations.
But I've done it with incredible help from a lot of sources, primarily a recovery program that I belong to. So I feel very strongly about recovery, and I know it's possible, and it's possible for any form of addiction, whether it's opiate addiction or alcohol or drugs. And there are so many programs that are free that deal with these issues, the 12-step programs being the most well known. So I was lucky. And along with this, of course, comes issues like suicide, which is a mental health issue. And my son took his life in 1992. Not surprising that he would. He had made a number of attempts, and then he was sober for a long time, and then he relapsed. And of course, in relapse, we know this is an illness, alcoholism and drug addiction. So we know that relapses are possible. And during that relapse, he took his life. And so it's horrible. It's a terrible thing to go through. Nobody wants to know about it or share about it because it's so horrible. That was the problem, though, because it's such a taboo to talk about it. So what I wanted to do was to write about it, to try to focus people on thinking about, most people that I know have suicide in their families or somebody that they know or some secret that's been kept, locked up for all years that nobody's talked about. So it's something that, of course, is relevant to all human beings because, as Camus said, it is the primary philosophical question that all of us have to deal with, no matter who we are, where we are from. So it supersedes gender, race, time, centuries. And if you don't have it happening to you or somebody you love, it's very interesting to think about suicide in terms of its history. I wrote a lot about that, and I thought a lot about it. My main job after my son's death was not to kill myself, because I had tried when I was a teenager. I tried. And I was suicidal most of the years when I was drinking.
Well, we are very, very glad you stuck around. We're grateful because, I mean, think of all the things that we're now, you know, including this Wolf Trap concert, you know, and all the great performances that are still to come. So we're so glad you're still with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. And wow, you know, you've been, we'll let you run. You've been more than generous with your time. I mean, man, you gave us a half hour of gold stories there. So thank you. Thank you so much. Again, everybody, we'll give a final plug here. It's Judy Collins recreating her 1964 performance at the Town Hall in New York. You can stream it on the Wolf Trap website at 8 p.m. Friday night, tomorrow. And I think it'll be available for rewatch for 48 hours after that. So tickets are $40. Head up to Wolf Trap. You can buy them there. And hey, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. God bless and have a great day. And stay safe.
You too. Yes, it's a really bizarre time politically, socially, and medically. This virus is ridiculous, but hopefully these vaccines will cut it down here. So stay safe.
Stay safe. God bless. Bye bye.
God bless you too. Bye.